Post of the kitchen. I just posted the first interview list for tomorrow. So these are the interviews for first half of those interviewing on Saturday, Monday and Wednesday. And the other sheet which I'll put up later on is for Sundays, Tuesdays and Thursdays. The interviews are not compulsory, so that if you don't want an interview that day, you can just put a cross next to your name in the column for that day. So if you don't want an interview, just put a cross next to your name in the appropriate spot. Okay, so that's, and try and be on time for the interviews. Just 10 minutes just on your meditation, and so maybe you can help overcome the problems and get you closer and earlier into the jhanas. So if you get into jhanas and enlightenment early on this retreat, then you can go home early. Okay, so here's the first question today. What is the difference and the effect on meditation of being glad of one's precepts and being proud of one's precepts? It's just gladness is really important part of one's meditation. So whatever makes you feel good, whatever builds up your confidence, whatever increases the energy of the mind, and that's a very, very effective means for empowering your meditation. Even little simple things, like if you're having a hard time in the meditation, it's getting pretty dull. Take your attention away from your breath or from your whatever you're watching. Put it on your mouth and just smile. A little smile, and then go straight back to your mind and you find it's easier to meditate. A story, when I was a student, and I, actually what I did, there was having these like three sherry mornings when I first went. This is when I was, before I had any precepts. And I went to get this free sherry, and it was a recruiting morning for the boat club. And so before I knew it, I'd signed on. The sherry was nice though. And I had to pay for it by going this stupid boat and rowing up and down the river. But it was good fun. And in one day, in one race, it was very hard work rowing. One day, in one race, there I was, sort of having a hard time, and the oar was getting heavier and heavier and heavier, and the coach on the towpath shouted through the megaphone, "You're making a really ugly face, smile for goodness sake." And, you know, you try these things. That was the first time I tried that. And when you smiled, it was true, the oar was easier to pull. It wasn't so heavy. It's an obvious thing which people should know, but we forget to use it as often as we should. If you actually smile when you're meditating, the meditation goes much easier. It's just the psychology of putting happiness into whatever you're doing. The happiness is the source of energy, gives you confidence, brightens up the mind, it's just more fun to do. So a little smile on your face makes life a lot less hard. So how you get that smile on the face? Being just glad of one's precepts, one's being a really good person. And that is actually one of the 40 meditation subjects in the commentaries which the Buddha taught, called Sīlanusati, just to reflect and remember your precepts and the purity, that one is being harmless, that one is being gentle, one is being virtuous. And in this world where when people are unvirtuous, they cause all sorts of problems and pain to other people. You're being harmless. At the very least, you're not causing any trouble on these 9 days. That's the very least. So that's something to be proud of. Because other people are causing a lot of mischief out there. So you think, oh, I'm being harmless to this 9 days. And it's not easy to keep those precepts. Because most people in this world don't keep those precepts. Unfortunately, it is the case that many people, they cheat on their partners, they lie, and they steal, and they very easily kill insects, let alone other human beings, other sort of beings. But here you're just being so pure in your virtues. So it is a cause of happiness. And remembering that, you can use your precepts to empower your meditation. And last Monday night, when we did the ordination ceremony for Venerable Vimoka sitting next to me, part of the chant which I had to do was to say, Silang Paribhavito, so Silang Paribhavito Samadhi Mahat Parohoti Mahani Sangsa. That when meditation is empowered by sila, by virtue, by precepts, it is of great benefit and great power. And that's one of the sayings of the Buddha. So with your virtue as a basis, it actually gives an extra oomph to your meditation. So you remember your precepts, reflect on them, and you can feel proud, increase your esteem, increase your gladness, that at the very least, you're living a very, very virtuous life on this retreat. So that's empowering your meditation. Any comments or questions about that? Just the same when people break their precepts, they feel really guilty and depressed, I hope. So when you do keep your precepts, you say, oh, really good, I'm doing well. And the other thing is, you've got nothing to fear when you keep precepts. When you keep your precepts, then you don't mind people sort of sneaking to your room to see what you've got under your bed. You don't mind when the policemen stop you, because, you know, you've got nothing to worry about, and you'll live a fearless life. My mind is usually very agitated during meal time. Can I use the mindfulness of the chewing motion as a meditation object when I'm eating? Or what do you suggest that I do? Thank you. If you're very agitated, it's very good to do impermanence meditation when you're eating. Just how quick that food disappears from your plate. Now it's there, now it's gone, impermanence. However, if it's agitated during the meal time, sometimes you can do what we call the one spoon at a time practice, or one fork at a time practice, whatever you use. Actually, I remember Venerable Kesari Dhammananda telling me once, he was at some sort of function somewhere. Kesari Dhammananda, he just passed away last year, he was a head monk at Brickfields Temple in Malaysia, very, very wonderful monk, wrote many books. And he once told me he was at some sort of function, and whoever laid the table out, you know, for his meal of the day, they only had one chopstick and just one spoon. So that's what he used. And apparently that someone saw him using a chopstick in one hand and a spoon in the other. And they took a photo of him, and it appeared in, I think, the New Straits Times with the caption, East meets West. One chopstick and one spoon. Well, one spoon at a time practice. When you're eating, sometimes you've already got something in your mouth, chewing. And you've got something on the spoon, waiting in line. And you've got a heap on your plate, which is not next. And you're looking what's coming after that heap on the plate. So you're about three spoons ahead of yourself. So instead of doing that, the one spoon at a time means you get what you want to eat on the spoon in your mouth, then don't put anything else on that fork or spoon or chopstick until you finish swallowing that piece of food. Don't even think what you're going to eat next. Certainly don't heap it up on your plate. It's one spoon or one mouthful at a time, and then you go to the next mouthful. Okay, so that's getting in the present moment. And that really slows you down. And when you actually can slow down that way, then, you know, your mind gets trained not to be agitated. Or even better than that, make sure you're the last in the line to take your food. And just think of the very best food will all be taken by the time you get there. Or whatever it is. So you do like what we used to do as monks. Sometimes in our bowls, we just put the food in there, and we get a spoon and stir it all up until there's this gooey muck, and then you start to eat that. It's good fun, but it still tastes nice anyway. So, but anyway, the reason why you're getting agitated, when all your other sense pleasures are taken away, there's no movies, there's no sex, there's no music, there's nothing to do except for the food. It's the only sense pleasure you have here. So that's why you get really sort of into it. Food coming soon. But it's a waste of time getting agitated, because it's going to be a long time until you can eat again. Another, how many hours? Almost 11 hours before you can eat again. Is there a difference between being attentive and being mindful? Actually, great question. Yes, there is a difference. Because being attentive is just actually knowing what's going on, but mindfulness is also knowing what you're supposed to be doing. This is really important. Mindfulness always has like an obligation to it, what you're supposed to be happening. So you can be attentive. As people can be attentive when they're watching the movies, I'm watching a movie, or I'm sort of robbing a house. You can be very attentive. Actually, burglars are very, very attentive. And actually, sometimes we use that sort of practice, a burglar practice. The burglar practice is this: whenever you leave this room, to go to the toilet when other people are meditating, think of yourself as a burglar. You have to walk so silently and so carefully. If you make any noise, the owner of the house will know you're there and is going to call the police and you get arrested. So like a burglar, move silently and carefully. And they can come back in the room after going to the toilet. And no one sitting here knows you've come. No one knows you've gone. You're like the burglar. So that's the burglar practice. And it's a great thing to do that when you're walking in and walking out. Well, number one, because it doesn't disturb the people sitting next to you. And number two, it increases your mindfulness. But really, the mindfulness, the old joke which I put in my book there, about the person who went to the Dhamma talk in a nice temple, and they were a wealthy person, so they had a guard on their house, and they told the guard, "Be careful, there are burglars in the area. So I want you to be very, very, very careful and attentive to keep my house safe from burglars." And when the owner goes to the temple, they had a nice Dhamma talk. When they go home, they found out the burglars have been in their house. And they tell the guard, "I thought I told you to be mindful." And the burglar said, "Well, I was attentive. I saw the burglars going in, and I noted, burglar going in, burglar going in, burglar going in. I saw them coming out with your jewellery, and I noted, jewellery going out, jewellery going out, jewellery going out. I was very attentive, I saw everything. I saw them go back in again, and I saw them." So, LCD TV set going out, going out, going out. "I was attentive all the time, madam. What's wrong?" Now, of course, you can see the problem there. Because that's not real mindfulness. Mindfulness means you actually know what's going on, but you're also mindful of the instructions. Mindful of the responsibilities. That's why, in Buddhism, mindfulness always remembers to switch off those beepers and mobile phones. Mindfulness, it remembers the instructions. In Buddhism again, mindfulness is sometimes, it actually is the same word as memory. Now the word mindfulness, sati, in Sanskrit, smriti, is a tradition. And actually, mindfulness and memory, just they're words which are almost exactly the same. Which means that what mindfulness truly is, it's like being attentive but also remembering the instructions. Remembering what you're supposed to be doing. So that's the difference there. And you'll notice that when you are meditating, you can be attentive to these thoughts and fantasies which are going through your mind. You know you're sort of thinking about the movie or the dinner or the sex or whatever. But you're not really being mindful because you shouldn't be thinking about that. That's one of the reasons why monks never tell if they can read people's minds, because if a monk could really read people's minds and they were willing to tell other people what you've been thinking, many people would run out of this place quick. So remember what we're supposed to be doing. Remember the instructions and be attentive. When those two are together, you know the instructions. Present moment awareness, be kind, be calm, be gentle, let go of things, be in this moment, be right here with what's going on. The more you remember the instructions, the more attentive you are, with those two together, your meditation really takes off. It's when we forget what we're supposed to be doing is the biggest problem. And that's when we drift. So any comments about that? Okay, the next one. Aha! Visiting a monastery regularly, I have witnessed on many occasions a resident monk speaking with harsh, aggressive speech to selected lay residents there at the monastery. In such a case, what should one do? I think you'd better go with a bodyguard next time. I don't know. It really depends on speaking with harsh, aggressive speech, what they're doing it for. I know that sometimes, and this is on one occasion, I don't mind saying this because I really respect Ajahn Sumedho, but I remember on one occasion that he tried, you know, using shouting speech on one of the disciples there, because we had a, this is many, many, many years ago, it must be about 30 years ago, in Thailand, and there was a French nun staying at the monastery, and that she was basically suffering from anorexia. She was hardly eating, and she was getting so thin, and there was plenty, it wasn't the best food, but there was plenty of food there, but she just didn't eat anything. We tried all sorts of things, and actually Ajahn Sumedho was visiting, and so the abbot at that time, I think it was Ajahn Pasanos, it must have been about 25 years ago, he sort of asked Ajahn Sumedho, can you help? So he called her to him, and he shouted at her, and bawled at her, and sort of was very, very fierce to her. And when I was sitting there, I thought, gee, Ajahn Sumedho's lost it, he's getting angry. And I really thought he, you know, was actually really upset. But as soon as the nun left, Ajahn Sumedho turned around with a big broad smile at me and said, that told her, didn't it? And he laughed. And if you're really angry, you can't change immediately like that. And he was actually acting it out to try and, you know, do something to get this girl to eat. But what I did notice, it never worked. Eventually that, the nun had to disrobe and get sent back to France and be around other people who could help her much better than we could at the time. Because if she'd have stayed much longer, you know, she'd have got very, very sick and died. But what I saw there, that aggressive and harsh speech, even though it was done without any anger, it was supposed to be like a skillful means, it didn't work, and I can never seen it work. And so I think if somebody tries to use harsh and aggressive speech because they think that's going to achieve the ends, you know, even actually good ends, skillful ends, I don't think it really is worthwhile. And a lot of time people have misunderstood, they think that monk is angry. And it's a bad example, because, you know, we're trying to sort of not just teach with words, but teach by examples and teach as leaders. And so if they see the monk getting angry, then other people think that's the right thing to do and shout at their wives, shout at their husbands, shout at their kids. And sooner or later someone will come and shout back at the monk. It depends who shouts loudest wins, and that's not a good way to live our life. So I don't know why he's doing that. But fortunately, not every monk does that. Is that any comment about that? About shouting monks? I know it's very exciting. Sometimes going to some monasteries when everything is just nice and smooth, it's not really interesting, but when somebody shouts and gets really angry, everybody listens. Everyone stops. I don't know why that is, but it's sometimes like exciting. Dear Ajahn Brahm, could you please comment on the Thai teaching of meditation as in the from head chakra to toe? Okay. So, the Thai teaching of meditation, I think what you mean is actually, it's not so much a Thai teaching, it's a general Buddhist teaching of actually knowing the different parts of the body from the head to the toe. I think that's what you meant me were talking about. That's just like a sweeping meditation. It's the Burmese do that, and they're very famous for doing a sweeping meditation. And it's a good meditation to do because, especially the first few days of this retreat, remember that you'll get probably quite bored at first just doing the breath all day. Because when you're at home, you know, you maybe do the breath meditation maybe once or twice a day at most, and that's on a good day. and now you've got 24 hours just about to do breath meditation, and after a while the breath is going to sort of really get up your nose, and not in the I suppose that's where it's supposed to go. But yeah, I think you know what I mean. You think, gee, you're just going to spend another half an hour watching this breath. I'm going crazy. So it's good to sort of switch it now and again and do different types of meditation, metta meditation, walking meditation. The sweeping meditation is actually just sweep, I usually start from the bottom of my body. Go to your toes. How are your toes now? What do they feel like? And can you actually get some sensations there? When you pay attention, you can actually notice there's something there. If you can't actually notice a feeling, just touch them and just massage them, and then you can actually get to your attention down there and feel your toes and just relax them, make them nice and peaceful and happy, soothe them, and then just move the attention up the body, to the soles of the feet and to the top of the feet, and move it through the bones as you go to the heel and then the ankle, but do it very slowly, and every time just feel whatever sensations you can there, soothe them, ease them, relax them. And only when they feel really good do you move up. And you move up the whole body to your knees, because many people when they're meditating get sore knees. Just when you get to the knees, just stop there and give attention. And just that kind attention sometimes is all you need to soothe any pain or aches there. When I was in Armadale group, I've been kept on saying that I remember as a kid going, playing football in the streets with my mates, and you'd always fall over, and you always tended to graze, take the skin off your knees and graze them. And whenever I used to fall over and graze my knees, which was, every few days, you used to go up to your mum and ask my mother to kiss it better. And so she would put her mouth with all those germs on the open wound. But it would never get infected, it always get better. All it was like a bit of kind attention, that's all. And that actually got the pain away, and then I went off to play football again. And that, not even with a plaster or anything, just a kiss better was always needed. And that's a degree of kind attention I knew as a kid was very, very powerful healing. And just, I know that even now, that if you've got an ache or pain in the body, you put some kind attention there. Just to soothe it. And a lot of times the body reacts, relaxes and gets more at ease. So if you've got any pain, as you're sweeping the body up through the sort of the thighs to your bottom, and spend a lot of time on your bottom, because that poor bottom has been supporting you for such a long time, especially on this retreat, on these cushions. I don't know how many cushions you have, but it still digs into your bottom. And so your buttocks are so important for your meditation, so spend a little time down there and care for the poor things. And just, a bit of care makes them more relaxed, and then go up the back. And as you go up the back, all the vertebrae and the muscles there, because it is difficult sitting down for a long time meditating. As far as the best posture is concerned, you don't have to sit with a perfectly rigid, straight back. I always thought that wasn't a good posture, and it's only last year that I read again in science journals, they say, straight vertical posture is not the best. People get back problems if they're vertical. 115 degrees, leaning back a little bit, is the best posture, so the experts say. And I always thought that way, because when you are in a chair, you like to lean back a little bit, don't you? And the reason you do is because you know that that's the best posture for you. It feels good. However, don't lean too back right now, otherwise you'll fall over on the person sitting behind you. But anyhow, just you find out what's the best posture for you, and yes, you feel it. And even as you go through the body sweeping, sometimes you can go to your organs. Go to your guts if you have got sore tummies, and just relax that area, just feel it. And just soothe it. It's like my mother kissing it better or whatever. And just imagine that somebody massaging it or something to soothe it, because it does help. And you go up, you've got sort of a bad heart or lungs or whatever. Stay there. It doesn't matter if you don't know what the lung looks like or a heart looks like. Just imagine it. Put your energy there, attention there, and kindness, and things tend to ease. So you sweep the whole body, and you get up to your shoulders, and I go down my arms. Always remember where my fingers are, make sure they're comfortable. Then go back to the shoulders and really relax them, and go up to the neck. Move my head from side to side to make sure the neck is happy. And one of the things which I do, I'm not sure where I got this from, some book a long time ago, just go to the over the back of the head, and I imagine a hole opening up in my head. Like, you know, when you're a kid, a baby has this little gap in the top of the head. And any sickness, any ache, any negativity, just imagine it like sort of smoke just coming out the top of your head and going out into space. It's just an imaginary exercise, but because it's an imaginary exercise, it does have actually psychological power. You know, any negativity, any pain, any frustration, just open that hole in the top of your head and let it all out. Like steam, it bubbles out and sort of fades away. And once it's all gone, you can imagine the hole closing up again. Otherwise it might come back in again. And it's gone. You go to the face, it relaxes all the muscles in the face. So you're sweeping through the body. Now of course you can go very, very slowly and very carefully and just see how much you can experience. And that's a great exercise on present moment awareness, pretty much silent, you're focusing on one thing. It's a great little meditation to get you peaceful and calm. At the same time, it's paying attention to your body, relaxing it, and it gives you much more freedom and ease from aches and pains. So that's a great way of, you know, just coming into some awareness and kindness to your body. Is there any comments or questions about that? Okay. What is right effort in the context of freedom from desire? Another great question. It was, again, a question which bamboozled me for many years, because was right effort you had to strive and work really hard to get enlightenment? Because every time you did strive and work really hard, I ended up just getting tense and then eventually frustrated. And that didn't seem to work. But then again, there was such a thing called Samavayama, which is usually translated as right effort. But then when you look at it in more detail, it is the effort is described as whatever you need to do to abandon unwholesome states of mind and to keep them out and to arouse wholesome states of mind and keep them in. Whatever is needed to achieve that. And that was the right effort. And I realize now that that right effort is an effort of letting go. Not an effort to do things, but an effort to calm, to still, to make peace, to be one with, to open the door of your heart to be kind to. Those efforts. And the other efforts is trying to get something, trying to get rid of something, you know, trying to have what we call the spiritual materialism of, you know, when you go out here afterwards, after the 9 days, you tell your friends, you know, what jhana did you get? And they say, oh, second jhana. Second jhana? That's nothing. I got second jhana on the first day. That's a one-upmanship and so spiritual pride. I mean, that's nothing to do with the path of Buddhism. So that's not the effort. We're not sort of trying to sort of see how much we can achieve and just, you know, get the prize for the best meditator on this retreat. That's not the point. We're trying to let go of all of that. That's all self and ego stuff. So the right effort is basically whatever works. Whatever makes you calm and peaceful and still and at ease. So you can experiment if you like. Screw up your mind and say, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to watch my breath no matter what. And see what happens. Or sit there and say, I'm going to be content whatever happens. And see what occurs. And you find out which is the right effort. I've done that for many years, I know which one it is. But maybe you have to find out for yourself. But remember, if you do contentment, you have to do it 100% fully in the moment. And that's how it works. So what Ajahn Chah always used to say, he used to say these amazing things which made no sense at all. One of the first things he said in the first year I was there at Wat Pa Phong, before Wat Nana Chart was made, was built, he used to say, Wat Pa Phong his monastery is a mango orchard. The mango trees were planted by the Buddha so long ago, and now all the trees are full of mangoes. You monks are so lucky. You don't need to even climb the tree or even shake it. All you need to do is to put your hand out and a mango will fall. I thought it was crazy. What did that mean? And it's obviously what he meant was, you know, the mango tree is like the Dhamma, and it's full of fruits, you know, the enlightenments, the jhanas and everything. And he said, it's already been done by the Buddha. You don't need to climb that tree or even shake it. Just put your hand out and the mango will fall. The more you shake it, the more you climb it, the longer it takes for that mango to fall. And that's straight from the words of one of the great masters, Ajahn Chah. And that's what it means. Of course, I never understood it. It never made sense. It was counterintuitive, because I always thought, if I want something, I have to work hard to get it. As I said this morning, that's not the way of Dhamma. That's why very few people sort of actually penetrate to see the truth of the Dhamma, because it goes in the opposite direction to the ways of the world. And it takes a lot of skill and guts not to do anything. Some of you may be able to do that for a little while, but then you always get involved and start controlling things again and doing things. So if you're really going to do the contentment practice, you've got to do it 100%. 99% doesn't work. Fully content. This is good enough. Give it a try, experiment. That's a great question, because that goes to the core of what we're doing here. Any comment on that?
Yeah, I have one question.
Yeah?
With respect to pride, say, achievement, say, in the precepts that we were talking about before, is that a hindrance when it comes to right effort and, say, contentment or freedom of desire? Or how does that fit in?
Okay, when you're talking about the, going back to the question of being proud, you're keeping your precepts. And is that going to create sort of desire, and that desire going to create the agitation of the mind which stops stillness and stops meditation happening? The sort of pride I was talking about there, because the English word has many meanings and connotations, the word pride I was saying, you're feeling good about yourself. Not to think, you know, that you are superior to other people. So it's just a feeling of like self-esteem and sort of inner contentment, and that word come out again. Rather than sort of feeling superior and seeing how pure you can get and see if you can be purer than the person sitting next to you. And you know, those are the pride, the spiritual pride, which is going to be a hindrance to the goal. But if it's just a feeling of good, then that's not going to be a hindrance. Here we go. Here is not a question, but an essay. Dear Ajahn, when one has stillness of mind and this continues and there is justice, obviously there is something that is obstructing going deeper. So if one looks but cannot see or feel anything as obstruction, what should one do? I cannot go deeper within and yet the mind seems to be quiet and still. I then look for the breath and try to refocus on this until it goes very quiet again. Then I just sit with this stillness and this cycle seems to repeat itself. This has been like this for a couple of years now. True, I'm developing patience, but there does come a point where I begin to think I'm missing something, doing something wrong. Please help. It's probably you've got some expectation there of something to happen. So the person is getting still, they're getting peaceful, but then nothing is happening. And they're expecting something to happen. I think it's that expectation which is probably going to be the main hindrance, stopping things developing. So you know, it has to be like 100% patience. Sometimes I've given a simile of, you know, renunciation, like being in a hot air balloon. To go high, you have to find something to throw out. The ballast. You know, you throw all the ballast out, what else can I throw out? Throw out your sandwiches and your thermos, and then you go a little bit higher. Every time you throw something out, you go up to the next stage. And that's a very, very wonderful simile for the path of meditation. So if you get to a stage, you're not getting deeper. What can you throw out? There must be some burden there, some attachment you're keeping. And it might be sort of, you know, the wanting it to go deeper, the anticipation, you know, the goals which you're setting for yourself. Which is why usually if you get to a stage like that, it's very wonderful to be able to remind yourself by repeating the mantra, this is good enough, this is good enough, this is good enough. Until you really know that this is good enough. I'm peaceful, I'm still, what more do you want? And when you're content there, and this is happy, you're so happy, you don't want to do anything else, you know, this is good enough, then you go to the next level. If you're expecting something to happen, waiting for something to happen, waiting for Godot, Godot never comes. That's Beckett play. So if you're waiting for something to develop, it never develops. When you give up waiting, you really let go, then everything just happens. So it's a great little place. Every place you get to in meditation, there's another test there for you to let go that little bit more, to be more content, to be less demanding. And that way you can go that bit deeper. So get to that stage, and this is good enough, and be so content with this. It really is, 100%, not just convincing yourself 99%, but 100%, this is good enough for me. And then it will develop. Yeah?
Ajahn, that letting go that you said, with respect to that question you just answered, does that ever actually occur? I can certainly relate to that question that you just read out there. What I'm trying to get, the meditation level stays the same in the inner world, but on the outside world, lots of things start moving around over the last couple of years. Can it sometimes happen on the outside world? So
the meditation in your stays at sort of an equilibrium level there, while you sort of get rid of your luggage and stuff on the outside world, we have a quantum leap to the other stage. Can be the case. You're saying that sometimes, as if I understand your response properly, that your meditation starts getting very, very peaceful, and then maybe has to pause while your worldly life catches up with it. And as you let go more and more in the world, then later on you go back to meditation, then you can go to the next stage. Certainly just the way you live your life has a lot of bearing on how your meditation develops, because you cannot just separate just, you know, your activities and your ordinary daily life, you know, and what you do in meditation, and think that you can somehow compartmentalize them and separate them. They do have a bearing on each other, which is why the people who do keep a simple lifestyle, who keep their precepts, are really kind, good, sort of not fault-finding people, so they will usually have very nice meditations as well. However, that there is still the possibility, you may be living the most heedless of lives, but there's still a possibility on a retreat such as this. You've got 9 days of purity, wonderful lifestyle. So, you know, even people who live quite sort of heedless lifestyles, on a retreat such as this, they can get deep meditation. Because, gee, I mean, my first retreat, was I still drinking alcohol? No, I think I'd given up then, but I was still sleeping with my girlfriend. And I still got a deep meditation, I couldn't believe it. So, and I wasn't sort of the most pure of beings at that time, but I still could get some nice meditation going. So, you know, you can do it. But it obviously helps, you know, to be sort of more virtuous. Does that make sense? Okay. Anyway, I think a lot. My mind just can't stop thinking. To sleep, I have to tire myself out from exercise so that I can simply knock out from tiredness. Meditation is difficult for me, but today I was able to enjoy silence, listening to the sounds of the birds without thinking. If I can sustain this for at least 10 minutes a day, is this a way to start as well? Yeah, sure. So, you can go listen to the birds every day. And maybe do the bird meditation. And then you become bird-brained. Okay, if that's not enough for you, just go outside, because there's lots of birds outside. Catch one. Put them in your room. And they can listen to that bird all day. Stop thinking. I don't know what you could get up to. But anyway, you will find just in this retreat, 9 days, your thinking will get less and less and less and less. And it will surprise you just how peaceful you get by the end of this retreat. Simply because there's nothing much to think about. All you can think about is, you know, just your memories and just what went on in the past and what's going to happen when you go home. But if you keep in the present moment, at least keep within these 9 days of retreat, there's not much to think about after a while. And so because you run out of things to think about, you run out of, you know, your fantasies or your dreams or whatever, and your plans, after a while it just grinds to a halt. That's one of Margaret Thatcher's famous sayings. She used to say to her cabinet ministers, she says, some cabinet ministers you can shout down, others you can beat down, and the others you grind down, she said. So that's what you can do with your thoughts. You can't sort of shout them down. You can actually beat them down. What you can't beat down, you grind down after 9 days of being in a joint like this. And you do actually, after a while, you get quiet. And it's quite surprise yourself. But then the best thing with silence is once you get used to it, the mind will incline there naturally. It just likes being silent. When it likes being silent and it's used to it, you'll find there'll be more silence in your life, more peace in your life. A lot of times people think a lot because they're afraid of silence. They're not used to it. So they always fill their head up with something to think about. Some fantasy, some dream. They don't have to, but they just don't know what else to do. But when you know silence and you get used to it, then you have this other alternative. You don't need to think. You can just be still and listen and be. And if that's all you get from this retreat will be just the best thing you've ever done in your whole life. If you know what silence is, you can turn to that at any time. But there was, when I was in Hong Kong, the people I was staying with, the wife, you know, said she can't go to sleep at night, she's always thinking. She was, what was she? A lawyer. And so she just asked for some advice. And I just gave her very simple advice. I said, when you go to sleep, or when you're in the bed at night, stop trying to go to sleep. You already know that the most comfortable place in this whole retreat is in your bed. When you wake up in the morning, do you want to get out of bed? Do you want to come to the meditation? No, it's just so nice. So, you know, you're cozy, warm, and you know, there's no aches and pains. And you feel lovely in your bed. And so remember that. That's one of the most comfortable, cozy places in the world, in your bed. So why waste that wonderful feeling by going unconscious in sleep? So tell yourself when you're in your bed at night, I don't want to go to sleep. I just want to enjoy this wonderful, warm, cozy, lovely feeling. I'm stretched out on the mattress and there's no aches and pains. Oh, this is so nice, so comfortable. So I told her that. And of course it worked, because as soon as she wanted to stay awake, she went to sleep. It's just basic psychology, you know, what we call reverse psychology. The more you try and want to go to sleep, the more you agitate yourself. But as soon as you don't care, you're quite happy to stay awake. Then you relax, and then you go to sleep. So she was very happy with me that sort of, you know, she had a house guest as a monk, and actually she was going to see a psychiatrist for that, and I saved her heaps and heaps of money. When one does metta meditation for different people, it is done to really convey your good feelings to other blessings, or is it for yourself to improve your mind? Okay, it's for both. Metta meditation, when you sort of share loving kindness, open the door of your heart to all beings. It's both helps yourself and helps other people. So it goes both ways. Whenever you sort of, you know, give happiness to others, you always get happiness back. Just the last 2 or 3 months at the monastery, there's the eldest cat in our monastery, Kit Kat. She's over 20 years old now. So because, you know, in Buddhism, when a person's 10 reigns or more, we call them Thera. 20 reigns are called Mahathera. So that cat's a Mahathera now. So that when she comes up, I know, sort of, some of the milk I have for breakfast, I put it in the saucer for the cat. No other cat's allowed to eat upstairs with the monks, but because she's a Mahatera, because we put a lot of respect to seniority, she's allowed to eat up with the monks. But this obviously a silly thing, but I get so much happiness out of just sharing some of the milk which is, I'm supposed to be drinking with a cat. And of course, whenever you give, whenever you share, you just get so much happiness out of it. So whenever you share kindness, loving kindness to other beings, it naturally just brightens up your mind and you get something back. Whether you want it or not, don't want it, it just happens. So it is not done for you, it's not done for others, it's done for all of us. That's why it's saying, may all beings be happy and well. And that includes you, because you are one of those beings. I do loving kindness in the morning on breakfast. May all beans be happy and well. All the baked beans we've been given. So when I see the beans, I do loving kindness meditation. Well, okay, we've got a deep question now. Quantum mechanics, physics, states that whatever you believe, you will see. Did it say that? Anyway, so can one stop the ripening of the seeds of karma by believing or thinking that karma does not exist? Wishful thinking. That would be so easy, wouldn't it? Karma does not exist, karma does not exist, karma does not exist. Pain does not exist, death does not exist, old age does not exist. Of course, you can't do that. What quantum mechanics physics states that whatever you observe, you interfere with. And, you know, actually you create some reality by your observations. But it doesn't say that, you know, what you believe you will see. Because obviously belief has some impact. What you're in denial of, you know, you can't see clearly, but it still has an effect. You know, even if you've got a cancer, say, and you're in denial, I haven't got a cancer, 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 still that cancer is there and it grows. So, you know, just belief is not good enough. However, it is a positive that if, you know, you visualize or believe you're going to get better, you believe you're going to get better, believe you're going to get better, that's obviously a positive. And it assists. It doesn't always work, but at least it assists the whole process of recovery. And it's just, if you believe you're not going to get better, then that certainly means, you know, you're going to probably get sick. That makes sense? So you can believe you're going to get jhana in this retreat. In the morning, look in the mirror and say, I'm going to get jhana, I'm going to get jhana, I'm going to get jhana. I believe it, I believe it, I believe it. And of course it won't work. Belief is not good enough. You need more than that. Any comment about that? Okay, next question here. Is there any significant difference between walking meditation and sitting meditation? If there, please tell us briefly. Yes. You're taller when you're walking, lower when you're sitting. I don't know. They say it's a significant difference. Surely it must be related to this. It's really funny, I mean, just even though, you know, what I say is not all that amusing, it's a strange thing. Whenever you get to sort of the end of a meditation day, people are so bored they're willing to laugh at anything. I've noticed this, people always get the giggles on the end of a meditation day. Anyway, walking meditation, sitting meditation. In walking meditation, I haven't described it yet, maybe one of these mornings I'll describe it in more detail. You choose a nice path, it can be in the corridor, it can be in one of the rooms, it can be out in the gardens. And you walk backwards and forwards, you make a path either between two trees, or if you want to put your slippers or shoes down, one on one end, one on the other end. And some people like a long path, some people like a short path, but you've got your two markers, one on each end, so you know exactly where you have to stop. It makes it simple, you don't have too many decisions to make. When am I supposed to stop, how much longer am I supposed to walk. You walk backwards and forwards, you put your gaze about 2 meters in front of you with your eyes open so that you are you feel quite safe, you're not going to trip over something, there's not a snake or an ant or something there going to bite you. So 2 meters in front of you, you look down, you don't look to the left and the right, you only look in front of you because that gives you a sense of safety. and you walk naturally, not too fast, not too slow, just as you feel comfortable. And you start off with present moment awareness, just trying to be now, you know, with the step happening now. So you don't think about, you know, where you're going to go to or where you've come from. Then you try silence, so you're not talking to yourself with a commentary. And then when you've got that basic mindfulness of silence and present moment awareness, then instead of watching your breathing, then you start just watching the movement of your feet. Just like you're breathing in and breathing out with breath meditation, how do you know which leg is moving, the left leg or the right leg? So it's the feelings and sensations in the feet you focus on. And you do that because they're simple, you can't say too much about them, and they're happening now. So they help you focus more in the present moment. And you're just with the feelings of the feet. And at first you don't see very much, just left foot moving, right foot moving. And then you refine it down till you see the very beginning of the left foot moving. What part of your foot lifts up from the ground first? And what second? And does it move vertically up, or does it go a little backwards or a little bit forward? And then what happens? Does it sort of go up and then suddenly go forward? Does it go in a curve? Or how does it move? So you feel all the sensations of one foot moving. And then when you step on the ground again, what part of your foot touches the ground first? What last? So that way that you get to know all the parts of one step. And then you see the next step happening. So you're filling the mind just with the feelings of walking until you get to the end of your path, and then you turn around, you know every movement of moving around, turning around, and then you start again, focusing just on the feelings in the feet. And the difference is that that's about as far as you can go with the walking meditation. You can get to what I sometimes call the beautiful step, like the beautiful breath. Because you're walking, you feel very happy, very content, having a great time. It's delightful to be so still, and you really start to enjoy it. And that's called the beautiful step. Like in the breath meditation, you get to the beautiful breath, you're breathing in and out, and you're having a wonderful time. You know, the next stage in breath meditation is when the breath disappears. And if you get to that next stage in the walking meditation, your walking disappears. And I remember Ajahn Yana telling me, I've never seen this, you know, one of Ajahn Yana's tales. There is a monk in Thailand who can get into jhana during walking meditation. He gets to that stage, he completely loses contact with his body, and he gets into these amazing states, but he keeps walking into trees. He's got all these bumps and scratches on his face, apparently. So it's not recommended to get into jhana while you're walking. You might walk. Walk out of this temple in front of a bus, I don't know. But anyway, actually you get a good rebirth if you get... so it's not all bad. But anyhow, that's not a good thing to do. So in walking meditation you can get so far, in sitting meditation you can get much deeper. That's the most significant difference. The depth of meditation, the depth of stillness. Any comments on that? Okay, we have two more questions. To my understanding, one reason for meditation is to stop thoughts before it solidifies. What if it's a thought or concept that is deeply rooted over years? What do you do with it during meditation? You uproot it. You spray it with those, what's it called? Roundup, yeah. You might get some of, what's it, they call it herbicides, fungicides or whatever. You might get some of that herbicide and spray it in your ear holes to get rid of all the thoughts so they don't make any roots. There is sometimes thoughts which have been going on a long time in your mind. They're habits. And those habits of thoughts or those habits of mind, those silly things which we do, the way that we stop them is with increasing our mindfulness. The more aware we are, the more we see that any habit of thinking or any habit of speech is a process. It begins, you start seeing yourself going in that direction, and you can stop yourself early if you can catch it. I told this to a fellow a couple of days ago. One of the monks, those of you long in, been here long enough, you may have seen him come here, Ajahn Anando. He died a few years ago, but he visited a couple of times in the early years of our monastery because he was an American who joined the Marines and went to Vietnam and got shot in the back of the head. And because of that, that injury, he had an epilepsy, because a part of the brain was removed. And you know, he's very intelligent, very kind, good meditator. But every now and again he would get epileptic fits. But because he was a meditator, you know, he told me that, you know, he was mindful enough he could actually see them coming early on. You know, he could catch them earlier and earlier and earlier. And he got to the stage where, you know, he could see them coming, and whatever he was doing, he would stop and go to his room and just relax, meditate. And he stopped having the fits. They didn't come anymore. Simply because he caught the whole process at a time when it was possible to stop them. You've got to catch them early to do that. And so that's like a physical habit of the brain. He managed with mindfulness, catching it early, to actually to get around. And that's what we can do with our speech, with our actions, because we find if it's like anger is a habit of our mind. Where does the anger come from? What triggers it? To catch the trigger earlier and earlier and earlier. And then if you catch it really early, you can actually take another route. Instead of going through that old habitual process, which you know is going to lead you getting angry at somebody or something. And that mindfulness is how we stop those habits. And it's the same if you have these thoughts which come up, which you have for a long time. Where do they come from? Catch them earlier and earlier and earlier. Maybe because something triggers it, like, you know, you're hungry or, you know. Oh, for example, there was a lady who came here for a retreat once, but she never wants to come on a retreat here ever again because she went to a Catholic boarding school, had a tough time in that school, and when she comes here, every time she sees a crucifix, she thinks, ah, and it just brings back those bad memories. You know, we do have those habits and those sort of, those triggers. You know, but you know, if she could only catch that a little bit earlier, you know, she sees that crucifix, and you know, she stops identifying that with her, you know, years in a convent school when she was young, then it wouldn't be so bad. She'd be able to stop the association, break the habits. So the earlier you can catch these things with mindfulness, the easier it is to break those habits. So whatever is that thought you've been having a long time, find out what triggers it. Now what is before that thought? What's before that which is before that thought? See the whole process, trace it backwards. And the earlier you trace it backwards, the easier it is to stop it. The simile which I gave years and years ago in Thailand, trying to cut down a mature tree is just so difficult. But that tree once started as a small sapling, as a tiny shoot, which anyone could, between with their two fingers, can pull out of the ground very easily. But once it's a big tree, it's almost impossible to take out. It's the same with, you know, these habits of mind. You're really getting into anger, you're really getting into a bad thought. Once it's there, it's a bit too late. If you can catch it early, it's very easy to do something about. And the last question this evening. I thought, always, spatting, accompanied by desire or aversion. Can a thought be neutral? Oh, sorry, no, it is. Is thought always accompanied by desire or aversion, or can a thought be neutral? You can have good thoughts, so it's not always desire and aversion. You know. So there are good thoughts, positive thoughts, and if you're going to have any thoughts at all, you might as well have the good thoughts. So first of all, abandon all the evil thoughts, all the psychopathic thoughts, and all the crazy thoughts. And once you've abandoned those things, all you've got left is the good thoughts. And then say if you abandon the good thoughts as well and get peaceful, beyond thoughts. Because again, this thinking is just an approximation for life. It's not life as it is. The old simile that thinking compared to reality. He's the same as a person who went into Northbridge one evening, like this evening, went to the most expensive restaurant and ordered the menu and ate the menu and paid and left. And that's a very stupid sort of diner. They lost a lot of money and they were as hungry as when they started. And of course, the simile of eating the menu is like just thinking life is the thoughts, and eating the thoughts, and thinking that that is all that life is. And you're missing the food. The thoughts have a place, they're pointing to the food. So if you have a thought, look where it's pointing, and make sure you eat the food and not the menu. The many people who eat menus, we call them professors. They research what other people do, and they write books about lots of thoughts, and they translate menus into many thousands of languages, but very rarely do they eat the food. So don't be the professor, just be the gourmet who enjoys the food. And you can see what type of monks we are, how fat we are. We just eat the food, we don't eat the menus. So live life rather than think about it. It's important to do that, because thinking will drive you crazy. And also thinking is actually, as someone said, you think about something like a satellite orbiting around the planet. It always goes about things, but you never actually go into it. It never lands on the surface of what you're thinking. So stop thinking and know. Just said Lao Tzu, as soon as you stop saying what a beautiful sunset, only then can you see the sunset. When you're thinking about it, you're missing it. The menu is different than the food. It describes the food, but it's not the food. Okay, so those are the questions today. And unfortunately there weren't that many, so now you have to meditate or go to bed. What time is it now? Is it 9 o'clock? 8 o'clock? 9. Okay, so the night is still young. When you are at home, what time do you go to bed? So why go to bed now? But also, when you're at home you don't get up at 4 o'clock, do you? Or 5 o'clock? So those of you who want to take a break can take a break. And those of you who want to meditate some more, please meditate some more. It's a very wonderful evening, nice and warm. You can go out and walk in the garden. But actually, what time do the doors get shut? Because I think it was actually happened last time we had a retreat here. Someone got shut out and they couldn't get back into their room. Okay, yeah, please take that. There was somebody last time, they were walking out in the garden, everything got locked up, and they had a very cold night. So either get inside early, or actually take your key. Okay, so have a nice evening, and have a nice meditation, and then we'll see you tomorrow morning, whatever time you feel like getting up. And the chanting is at 6 o'clock, so if you want to come up for the chanting, that's fine. Well, if you want to do your own chanting in your room, you can do your own chanting if you wish. But please don't do it so loud you wake up the person next to you. So have a nice evening. See you tomorrow. Good night.